Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Mark Thompson, Lib Dem blogger, and also regularly featuring Emma Burnell, a Labour blogger who blogs at Scarlet Standard. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, and we're recording this on the evening of Sunday, the 28th of April. We have a canter through the political stories of the previous week. Emma, you were away for the last, well, I think you were away on holiday last week and the week before you were ill. So
we've had, That's right.
Had a couple of weeks off. So I hope you had a nice break.
I did. Thank you very much. And I have missed you all.
Okay. So the first thing we thought we'd talk about today is Len McCluskey versus Tony Blair. It sounds like a blockbuster.
Yeah.
I'm not too familiar with this story. So
Attack of the Dinosaurs.
Yeah, you'll have to fill me in, Emma, on what's been going on here.
Well, from what I understand, Tony Blair contributed a piece to the New Statesman's 100th centenary edition. Not 100th edition, but 100 years edition.
I was going to say 100th centenary edition, but they've been going 10,000 years. That would be quite impressive.
It would be impressive. 52 a year over 100 years is not quite that many yet.
Right. But, it's still a lot, though. A lot more than I've done blog posts, let's put it that way.
Yes. Yes. Or we ever will, Mark, probably.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so he contributed. His piece basically kind of set up this, and I'm going to use those two words that you know I love to use, false dichotomy of it's New Labour or Old Labour. You're either the Labour of the 90s or the Labour of the 80s. And you, if Ed keeps going the way he's going, Labour will drift into its comfort zone of oppositionalism and 80s Labourism, and that will be all terrible. And then he asked seven questions, some of which were reasonable questions, although I don't suspect he'd like the answers. For example, one of them was very much about continuing New Labour's marketisation of the public services, which has been very much something that we've rode back on very strongly since 2010. And in fact, even before then, because Andy Burnham, when he was Health Secretary, rather than Shadow Health Secretary, was very much reversing a lot of that stuff that happened. which has made us stronger to oppose the changes the coalition have made. Some of them were just a bit odd. I felt like the seventh one, which was something like, how do you use advances in technology to fight crime? At first, I thought it was a kind of a will this do question. But it occurs to me what he's really saying is, how friendly do you want to be to the Lib Dems? without actually saying how friendly do you want to be to the Lib Dems. So it's a reasonable question. It's just posed in a really, really, really odd way. So that all happened, and then everyone on the left went, "Ooh, no, we don't like that. That's horrid. Tony Blair has an opinion." Including me, because his opinion was gauchely put at best. He's not often of the left, but he's getting increasingly a gauche, if you ask me. That's the start of it. And then last week, Len McCluskey had an interview in the New Statesman. Are you there?
Yeah.
Sorry, you've just gone really quiet.
I'm listening with fascination, Emma.
Last week, Len McCluskey had an interview in the New Statesman where he continued a theme that some on the further left of the Labour Party have of calling the Blairite zombies. And Ed Miliband mustn't be seduced by the Blairites. And he actually went named names of Douglas Alexander, Jim Murphy and Liam Byrne. And in particular, focus has been on Liam Byrne. And if Labour continues to listen to them, then they will be swept up into the New Labour comfort zone, which we need to move beyond. And then all the right of the party went, "Oh, that's terrible. Oh. Len McCluskey shouldn't say that," including me, which also puts me in an interesting perspective of thinking both of them are acting the goat. And while I don't think they should shut up, because I think everyone's entitled to their opinion, I don't think their opinions are necessarily the things that we should be particularly listening to. It's also my strong, strong opinion that Len McCluskey needs Liam Byrne because he needs a straw man to keep hitting out at. And if without Liam Byrne, he doesn't get to, you know, if there was somebody doing the kind of things that Labour are looking at on welfare that was more popular than Liam Byrne, say Kate Green, Len McCluskey wouldn't be able to garner the kind of plaudits for attacking that he does.
Now, I think on a slightly broader point, I find it a bit sad, really, that Tony Blair, it feels to me like he's lost his touch. I think he was losing his touch in his last maybe 2 or 3 years in office. A little bit like with Margaret Thatcher, I think in his early years and in her early years, I think they both did have quite in both cases, a very good sense of a kind of connection with the electorate, if I can put it like that. I think Blair was very good at understanding kind of middle Britain, certainly the kind of people who would help swing elections you know, in the marginal constituencies. And I think he did start to lose that towards the end. And I think now that, I mean, he spent the last 6 years gallivanting around all around the world, hasn't he? My understanding is he doesn't spend very long in the UK. And I think that's deserted him. I think if he was still active in politics somehow, so let's say he'd remained an MP and was a backbench MP, I mean, it sounds almost ridiculous to say this, doesn't it? Because that just isn't Blair at all. But if he'd have done that, and if he'd have stayed in touch with what was going on here, I think his analysis of what is happening in contemporary politics would be more interesting. And I think he may well have some good points to make. As it is, from what I've read about what he said, I think he's like a general fighting the last war.
Absolutely, absolutely. He is understandably protective of his legacy. But he is too protective. He can't see the wood for the trees. He's protecting a legacy, which should be about protecting the record, but he's actually just trying to crystallise a dogma. And that, you know, that was everything New Labour was supposed to not be. And it's become a dogma in and of itself. It's become a second comfort zone. And neither of them are actually very helpful for a post-crash analysis of what Labour needs to do now.
Yeah. And what is it about former prime ministers? Because Thatcher was pretty bad with this as well. I mean, once she'd left office, she couldn't help but stick her oar in. And, I mean, Heath was kind of Thatcher's nightmare, wasn't he? For decades, he did hang around on the back benches. And I kind of hoped maybe Blair wouldn't be like that. And I think, to be fair to him, he has largely stayed out of things. But every now and then he does seem to come back. And I suppose what happens is whatever he says gets amplified, doesn't it? So it gets reported. And then, you know, there's reporting on the reporting of what he said.
You have to stay off Twitter for about an hour around any time that Tony Blair has given the speech, because the Blairgasm is just too ridiculous. and yeah, either the hate-gasm or the love-gasm, but they're both equally insane.
But funnily enough, I think the template that, say, John Major has set out as a former prime minister is a much better example, because he's not been prime minister for 16 years now. He very rarely intervenes. And when he does, he actually does seem to have quite sensible things to say.
I think, to be fair to him, Gordon Brown is doing the same thing.
Yes, I think you're right, actually. Although maybe in the case of Brown, it's a bit too soon.
He's in the most recent prime minister. He's a constant figure of hatred from the right, but he's not fighting for his you know, loudly fighting for his legacy. He's doing a lot of work for charity and being a backbench MP. And when he has spoken out, it's always been on a topic in which he can be helpful to Ed Miliband rather than unhelpful.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Although there's a lot of complaints that he's not in Parliament enough, but that's maybe a debate for another day. So do you think this intervention from Blair will have any effect?
No, but then neither will the one from Len McCluskey. I think both of them are just having this crazy headbutting macho shithead contest. And it's completely unnecessary. And they're not doing it to have an effect on the Labour Party.
Well, if Blair really...
quite honest, neither of them are doing it because they think it's going to have an effect on the Labour Party.
Yeah. If Blair really wanted to be influencing policy, wouldn't he be doing this behind closed doors with the key people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not like he couldn't get a meeting.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And didn't he
and
make
the
some
same for
slightly...
Len.
Yeah. Didn't Blair make some slightly pejorative comment about we need good leadership or something, which...
Something like that.
I mean,
it was a kind of comment that you can get away with because you don't necessarily... You can read it one way or the other.
Yeah.
But of course, he's not stupid.
Yeah, but exactly. And it seemed to me a little bit too clever. It reminded me of Brown's comment, this is no time for a novice, which was ostensibly against Cameron, but was probably actually against David Miliband.
Well, it was a two-for-one, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a pretty similar thing going on here. He's allowed to criticise leadership, in quotes, and that does appear to be an attack against Cameron, but actually it's equally barbed against Ed Miliband, isn't it? And he's far too experienced a political operator not to have known that that's how that particular aspect of what he said was going to be reported.
Of course. And, you know, he's wrong, but... And he's allowed to be wrong, and I can say, Tony, you're wrong... And then just, but my problem is there are certain people who cannot move beyond either what Len McCluskey wants or what Tony Blair wants to actually find a nuanced place where Labour can actually develop something that's new and is better and isn't either of those dogmas or either of those comfort zones. And actually, that's where most Labour Party people are, is in neither of those comfort zones. It's out there trying to find ways that work now. But there are a few vested interests, and they are very, you know, very much invested in their own power, invested in their own reputation, invested in their own relationships, not invested in the future of the Labour Party, not invested in the future of the country, that are just playing their own games. And it's not the same thing as having the best interests of the Labour government, future Labour government, and the future of the country at heart. And it's really sad because both Len McCluskey and Tony Blair have really interesting and valuable things to contribute. But if they can't do so in such a way that allows dialogue rather than monolithic speechifying and, you know, just setting the dogs on everyone, then it's not a helpful contribution.
Okay. Well, maybe we should move on to other matters now. So the next thing that we thought we might talk about is, this is a subject that's been rumbling on and on and on for years, actually. But Ian Duncan Smith made some comments this morning. It's about pensioner benefits, the universal benefits that pensioners get. So I think it's specifically the fact that over 75s get a free TV licence, which is worth about £150. And pensioners get a winter fuel allowance, which is either £200 or I think £300 if they're over 80. And they also get free bus passes. And he made some comments which, I mean, I think are a bit... Well, first of all, they are off message because David Cameron very clearly nailed his colours to the mast before the 2010 election. During the leaders' debate, actually, he made it very clear that a government led by him would not be touching these universal benefits for pensioners. And he's reiterated that since. So the fact that Ian Duncan Smith is now saying, well, first of all, he's pointing out that they are an anomaly. And I think he said something like it would be better if they weren't, you know, if they weren't universal. And what he suggested is that better off pensioners, although he doesn't define what that means, unsurprisingly, should hand these free benefits back. And I think there's a few aspects to this. The first one is there is no mechanism for handing them back, as Ken Clark pointed out a little bit later on. So, you know, the idea that there's going to be a big queue of wealthy pensioners outside the Treasury with cheques for, you know, £450 or whatever it is just completely unrealistic. Maybe a few wealthier pensioners may give this money to charity. Maybe some of them already do. Some of them do. But there's a broader question here about whether it's fair for pensioners, no matter what their income, to get these benefits just by right. I mean, what do you think, Emma?
Well, there are arguments about universality that are quite complicated. They seem to be twofold, as far as I'm aware. The first is that universality means that we all buy into the system. Everyone believes in the welfare system because everyone gets something out of it at some point in their lives. Now, unfortunately, I can read a poll as well as anyone else can, and it doesn't look like that has worked. People aren't buying into the system. They don't believe in the system. I wish they would. I think it's a good system. But I'd have to be the worst cockeyed optimist in the entire world to say that people are happy with the welfare benefit system. So that argument for universality, I think, is failing. The other argument is that it is cheaper in the long run to have universality there other than means testing, because means testing is so complicated and expensive to run that actually you lose money by doing it. And that is that's a really difficult argument, because it's the kind of bloodless bureaucratic argument that makes a great deal of sense, except for politically when people are getting very upset and angry about benefits. So, I mean, it's like the bedroom tax, for example, which will cost more, but people who fall for the arguments about the bedroom tax think that it's okay. You know, of course people should be having a smaller house, without thinking about all of the other factors that affect it. I mean, it strikes me again as very, very Ian Duncan Smith to ask politely for the rich people to possibly, if they wouldn't mind, give their benefits back while snatching every single possible penny you can get for the poor, for their own good, of course.
Yeah, I mean, I think, to be fair to IDS, if he had his way, he would be stopping these universal benefits. I think it's pretty clear that's what he wants, but he's constrained by what his government, you know, what his prime minister is going to allow him to do, and what his prime minister promised before the last election. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a bit weak, isn't it?
It's a bit rich.
To be pleading with wealthy pensioners, please, please, please give your money back. You know, well, really, that then does beg the question, why the hell are they being given it in the first place? And I think there's a number of different factors at play here. I think the first one that's the elephant in the room is that the reason why these benefits are being kept universal for pensioners is predominantly because pensioners vote more than younger people. Mm. So when politicians are having to take the difficult decisions about what to do, it's actually quite an easy decision to say, well, we're going to keep the universal benefits because older people vote. Now, I'm not saying politicians, you know, meet in a smoke-filled room and evilly cackle as they decide to do this. I don't think it works like that. What I do think happens is that it's just unspoken. It's understood that that's how it works. You know, I mean, people respond to incentives, as any economist will tell you. And a very strong incentive for a politician is to want to make sure that they win elections, keep their seat, etc. And part of that is that you have to respond to the demographics who vote more than others. And I think that this is one example of that. I think it's also, I mean, there are a number of different things that have happened to different age brackets. But I read an interesting statistic, which I think I gleaned from that there was a Fabian Society report earlier this week I think it did cover pension benefits, but it was also talking about tax rates. Mm. And it said that in the last few years, middle incomes for retired households had risen 5%, while overall they'd fallen for middle income households by 5%. So you can see that pensioners have been protected from that. Another thing is that pensioners...
Hang on though, but if we think about it, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, we were almost completely up in arms all the time about pensioner poverty. And there was a real issue of pensioners who were incredibly poor and losing out a great deal. So it's worth thinking about where those 5% have come to and from. I'm not saying, you know, we don't talk about pensioner poverty anymore. It is a thing that has been eradicated from political discussion, largely because these benefits have come and come and come. So therefore, it's not an issue anymore. But it is, before we start talking about they've been protected, they were very unprotected 20 years ago and have been brought up.
Yeah, but giving, you know, wealthy pensioners winter fuel allowance and free TV licences isn't doing anything to help pensioner poverty. I mean, if anything...
Well, again, that's the argument about universalities, is to whether it does, because you're doing everything at the same time. And I'm not that wedded to that argument, but it is worth considering, because certain economists will absolutely tell you that it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, well, the Fabian Society report, I mean, I wrote this down, you know, it said there is really significant intergenerational unfairness, where you've got retired mid-income households paying 27% gross income in tax, compared with 33% for non-retired households in the same, you know, with exactly the same income. Yeah. And really, I mean, just because someone's older Should that mean that they pay less tax? I mean, is this an in-principle thing that if you're older, you should pay less tax and you should get these benefits? Because at the moment, the way things are stacked up, it's the people of working age that are being hammered, and the pensioners are actually being protected from all of this stuff. I mean, is that fair?
I don't know. I don't have a problem with the tax burden tapering off towards the end of life, but I think that we have an issue with the fact that end of life is later generally than it was, but is very, very differentiated between the classes and where you live. So things like the retirement age, there's a lot of movement to move the retirement age higher across the board, which would be another universal measure that would help rich people more, because people who are poorer, people who live in poorer neighbourhoods, and people who have done more manual work die earlier, so we'll get less of the benefit overall. So it's the problem is that we're looking at these very broad brush things that are actually a lot more complicated on the margins.
Yeah, and that is a tricky one because you're right. I mean, I personally, I have no problem from, from my perspective, from my life perspective, with the retirement age going up. In fact, I mean, it's got to happen. People are living far, far longer, and the idea that you can spend, 25, 30 years or more in retirement, the retirement ages as they were 2 or 3 years ago, with the way life expectancy is increasing, was unrealistic. But I'm privileged, as we've talked about before. I'm sure we've talked about my privileges on numerous occasions. I'm middle class. I earn a decent wage. I don't work in manual labour. I could probably do what I do for a very long time. And there are people, as you rightly point out, who wouldn't be able to do their job for another 30 or 40 years at my age. I'm 38, just for reference. So yeah, it's a tricky one. But I suppose you're always going to rub up against these sort of problems when you're trying to make rules for everyone. And yeah, I mean, I suppose you're right that it's the wealthier pensioners who would benefit most from that. I mean, just coming to a little bit of the other stuff that the Fabian Society did you see that? Because I know you were away, you might not have seen this, that they released this report.
I haven't read, I have to admit, I haven't read that. They did two reports this week and I've managed one and not the other.
All right. Well, I only read a précis of it. I don't know all the details, but it also, I think its main point was talking about equalising the tax system. So that really their argument is that there is no justification for the tax rates to be different for people of different ages.
Yeah, I mean, that strikes me as fair. Having the tax rates equalised is fine, as long as the incomes are also equal.
Yeah.
But the problem that you'll have is that people will have done their financial planning towards retirement, and there will be uproar from people for who are about 50 plus, because they will have to then work longer in order to get the savings into place to pay the extra tax.
Well, I think the other problem, just in terms of practical politics, is that this is obviously a Fabian report. Presumably, they're trying to influence the Labour Party to adopt
Oh
this as
yes, one would
policy.
hope that they're members of the Labour
Well,
Party.
yeah, exactly. And therefore, I don't see how Labour can adopt this, given the massive fuss that they kicked up about what they called the granny tax, when the current government basically tried to do what this report is suggesting. And I think that is a problem with this. I mean, I do wonder if it's even possible to have a rational debate about these things, because someone somewhere will always come up with some catchy term, whether it's granny tax or whatever they want to call it. I mean, I'm sure if a movement starts politically to means test these benefits or to do something to make it fairer, these TV licence and winter fuel allowance, I just know that there are going to be people in opposition to this who will come up with some way, of terming this that you're going to be causing pensioners to die in their homes of hypothermia. And it makes it really, really difficult to have a sensible debate about this. And when Labour kicked off about the granny tax, what were your thoughts about that? Did you think that was a fair thing to do? Do you think that was an accurate way of representing what was going on?
It was a tax on pensioners, we call it a granny tax.
Well, it wasn't, though,
I
was it?
think
All it was doing was
you're quite
aligning the pension
idealistic
rates.
about a lot of things, Mark, except when it comes to your party doing it. Your party would have coined the term granny tax in a second and had a party political broadcast featuring a granny who you'd made up. Talking about her hypothermia that was all because of the evil Labour government, and for some reason it would also have something to do with AV or her first post.
I'm sure it would be system. Well, to be fair, Emma, before you continue, I am on record on many occasions criticising my own party's policy, and if they'd have done that, if we'd have been in opposition, I can't absolutely guarantee I would have done, but my instinct is I would have been against it, because I don't like reducing political debates to ridiculous black and white caricatures. I really don't like that, and I've never liked that. So, you know, I don't just criticise other parties.
I also don't think that it's essential that you... I think just because Labour have opposed the granny tax doesn't mean that we can't be persuaded of an argument to change tax rates for older people, if that's the right thing to do. I think that Labour have campaigned on a number of things over our 108 years, whatever it is. And I suspect we've changed our minds over that time. So there's perfectly possible to have a rolling dialogue rather than individual set points in time that we will believe in one thing forever. Well, certain principles, of course, they're the essential principles of the party, but they're not... I don't think the age at which and the rates at which everyone's taxed.
Actually, just thinking about what you were saying there about the way that the Lib Dems would campaign, if they were in opposition. I mean,
just picture the bar charts.
I can picture the bar charts. It would be very pretty, but I probably wouldn't agree with what they were trying to do. The
you
most recent
deliver the leaflets.
The most recent party political broadcast that they had, the Lib Dems, was this one. What would you do? What will you do with your £600 that you're?
Yes. Now this is really interesting to me. This it is quite extraordinary to me. For 10 years or so of the Labour government, I was having discussions with Lib Dems where they were telling me, "We're not about left and right. We're not about the economic scale. It's all about it's about liberal authoritarianism. We're changing the dynamics of politics. We're moving it onto the civil authoritarianism axis." And the one thing that the Lib Dems keep telling me about their success in government is a tax break.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to say, though, don't you? Because you predicted it about 3 minutes ago. If we had a different electoral system, they'd be able to campaign like that. Anyway.
But it is extraordinary. I mean, you've got 5 years of government. And, okay, you're a small party in a coalition. You are not going to get everything that you want to get out of that 5 years. I accept that. I think you've bent over badly on some things that you shouldn't have done because they're as damaging to you as they are to the country. But there are things you've had to swallow that, of course, you've had to swallow stuff because you're a small party in government. But you haven't got one single thing that is particularly liberal. You haven't got one single change to the way we do our democracy. And that is quite extraordinary failure. You haven't changed the narrative in the way that you had your first opportunity to in nearly 100 years.
All right, just stay there for a sec, because I'm going to just take my normal hat off and I'm going to put my party hat on. So hang on, I'm just putting it on. Right, it's on. Okay. Well, we killed the Snoopers Charter for the second time this week.
Yeah, not Tories... having things happen is not the same as achieving things.
I know. And so, you know, I am aware that that isn't a change. It's preventing something from happening that would, in our view, have been worse. Now, I think there's been lots of wins like that, some of them under the radar, some of them above the radar. We are a small minority within the government. If we can kill some of these things that the Tories would have done had they have been in on their own, maybe it's something that the electorate won't particularly appreciate, but I think a lot of the activists and members will appreciate that stuff, especially after the debacle of what happened with secret courts. I think, realistically, Clegg had no choice but to kill this Snoopers Charter, because I think there'd have been a revolt within the party if he hadn't have done. It's not accurate to say that we've not been able to achieve anything. We've not been able to achieve everything that we'd have liked to have done. And it is a bitter disappointment that the whole reform agenda, electoral system for the Commons and reform of the House of Lords, all that stuff that, you know, is almost every Lib Dem would agree should be done. You know, it's one of the things that unites us, hasn't happened. But you know, that's the reality of coalition. And I agree with you that the raising of the tax threshold isn't something that you would really characterize on that authoritarian, libertarian axis, whatever you want to call it. But you get your wins where you can. I mean, we're in office with a bunch of people who, quite a lot of them, their instincts are pretty authoritarian. And the idea that you're going to be able to liberate everything that you would want to under those circumstances
not
is isn't realistic.
Just one thing.
Well, we killed the Snoopers Charter, you know.
Government, having changed one thing, not prevented one thing, having changed one thing, having one thing that you can go back to your party and say, you know, those things that are core to our values, that we said, yes, it's time to go into government to do something about putting our values into practice. Well, here's what we've achieved. Not what we've stopped, what we've achieved.
Well, like I say, you know, I think that the party has achieved quite a lot in government. But in terms of a big ticket item that you could say, look, here is something that, you know, has massively freed up the country from the influence of the state, or however you would want to term it, any of those policies. That has been really difficult to get through because of who we're in coalition with. And incidentally, I think it would have been difficult to get through if we were in coalition with Labour as well. So
I agree, but I'm not talking about who you're in coalition with. I'm talking about your party and what your party is for and what the point of having your party is if they're not going to achieve things when they get into government.
Well, the answer is for more people to vote for the Lib Dems, isn't it? And then maybe the party eventually could get a
Why
majority.
Would you do that when you don't have anything to offer?
Well, I'm clearly not going to agree with that.
It really strikes me as a waste of the one possible, possibly only for a while, possibly not, but, you know, big opportunity that you have to prove that it's okay to be liberal.
All right, but, you know, you suggested that I was being overly idealistic. And I think the idea that we can get into government and have a seventh of the MPs that form that government and then push through a massively liberalising agenda is unrealistic.
I'm asking you for an agenda, Mark. I'm asking you for a thing. One thing. You have supported the Conservatives on a lot of things that your party are not happy about. And all the win that you're claiming is a tax cut, which the Tories are perfectly happy about, and are claiming the credit for themselves.
Yeah, well, you know that that's not all that the party's done, and that's not all that the party's claiming credit for. You know, I mean, I have highlighted some of the things that, you know, we've been able to stop. But clearly that's
stopping stuff and do something.
Clearly that's not good enough for you. But we're going to go around in circles here because, you know, a minority party in government is very restricted in what it can and can't do. I mean, all it really has at the end of the day as leverage is we could walk away from this coalition. And of course, they could do that. Now, the polls are such that realistically, that ain't going to happen. You know, when you're polling at 8% and 9%, when you were previously polling at 23%, you know, that isn't going to happen. The Tories know that. So the Lib Dems' hand in government isn't very strong. If the Lib Dems were polling at 20 or 25% or higher, they could use that leverage to get loads of liberal stuff through. I would actually question how democratic that would be, given, you know, how many MPs the party's got. And, you know, you've got to be realistic here that the Tories got 37.
Do lots of things. I just think that if you are going to try and change the narrative to make a liberal party an attractive vote winning party, if you are going to say it is okay to have a party that primarily focuses on liberal issues rather than a party that primarily focuses on economic issues, you need to do something that makes that the narrative.
Well, what?
Instead, what you've done is succumb to the economic narrative and make all your only gain about a power tax cut.
All right, OK, I'll give you an example, OK? It's pretty clear from what Clegg said a few months ago, and this is certainly a very strong feeling within the grassroots of my party, that we would like to see reform to the drugs laws. We would love to see that. You know, if in 2 years' time I was able to say, look, we got the drugs laws liberalised, you know, we decriminalised cannabis and perhaps some of the other drugs, and, you know, there's a much more progressive regime in place now. We're not locking people up for possession of small amounts of drugs. And, you know, we've changed the way that this issue is approached so that it's no longer under the purview of the Home Office. It's actually under the purview of the Department of Health. Stuff like that. That would be brilliant. But you saw what happened. Clegg said what he said. It's clear what the party's view is. In fact, the party stated policy that my friend Ewan Hoyle piloted through conference a year and a half ago is to have a much more progressive policy on drugs. But, of course, what happens is that the Conservatives basically block it. Labour wouldn't back it either. So what can the party do? The party's got 57 MPs. How is it supposed to get that through? It's just not realistic to think that they can. Now, you're saying, so what is the point in voting for Lib Dems?
But you could have had House of Lords reform.
How? The Tories blocked it.
Yeah, the Tories blocked it, but you could have had it by making the deal. You could have made a deal. There were deals on the table that Tories would have followed.
Really?
But you could, yeah, apparently. I mean, this is what I'm reading.
No, I don't believe that at all. I think that the Tories, you know, they're not called conservative for no reason. You know, they don't like changing stuff. They definitely don't like reforming, Parliament in any way. They want to keep the Lords the way that they are. And they have all kinds
of... But you could have had House of Lords reform by actually just following the Labour timetable and taking some time to do it right.
No. You're saying that you think that that was possible. I disagree with you very strongly. I think Labour did what they did because they wanted to kill it, because they wanted to spite the Lib Dems. That's what I think happened.
I don't think they wanted to spite the Lib Dems. I think they were quite happy that it turned out to boundary changes. We cared more about boundary changes than House of Lords.
Exactly. There was a very complex play.
You could have called our bluff and run it by our timetable and it would have passed.
No, I don't think it would. I think there would have been further spanners in the works further down the line. It wasn't realistic and it wasn't going to happen because our coalition partners couldn't be relied upon. The backbenches blocked it and Labour were playing silly beggars with it. And so it fell. So the idea that that's the Lib Dems' fault.
It's not the Lib Dems' fault, but you could have had more backbone and you didn't. And you let something go that you could have said, no, this is the one.
Well, I just...
We've not had a voting reform. We're not doing anything particularly liberal. This is the one thing which we will, we'll bring down the government over because it's that important.
Okay, riddle me this. How do 57 MPs in a house of 650 MPs force through the legislation that they want like this?
Well, at the time, the Conservatives were at something like 29% in the polls. They wouldn't have gone for a general election. You just keep pushing and you say, if you vote against this, we will break the coalition.
Well, I just don't think that's
realistic. And if you believe in it strongly enough, then you will accept that you'll be out of government after breaking the coalition, but you will have made a change that will last forever.
Okay, a coalition that was formed primarily to try and have stability at a time of financial crisis.
It's going
that
so
goes,
well.
That goes to the wall and is dissolved because one party wants to reform the House of Lords. You really think that that was going to be a workable scenario?
Well,
I don't see how that would ever work.
You're a complete mess economically, and you still are. So you've not done any of that stability.
But as we talked about before, Emma, we don't know what the counterfactual is here.
That it's important to change our democracy, then you give up power to do it.
Okay. Well, I personally wanted House of Lords reform, and I may well have played it differently had I been in a position to make any of the decisions about this. But you have to accept, Emma, that the shenanigans that the Tories and Labour were both at on this made it turn out the way it was. If Labour had decided to back...
Well, you're not the innocent party. It's not all the big boys did it and ran away.
I never said that. I said that the idea that it's the fault of 57 MPs when we need hundreds of other MPs to vote with us from either party...
57 MPs could have used their power better and they did not, and that would be something that I will judge them on.
Well, you can judge them. And that's obviously going to come down to a matter of opinion that people are going to judge. And I agree with you that when we go to the electorate and we're saying we stopped this, we stopped that, we weren't able to do this for this reason and that reason, that's not going to tell a great story. But that's the reality of coalition and that's the reality of the situation that we found ourselves in. I also think that the electorate are going to think it's pretty self-indulgent for us to go on about things like House of Lords reform when, you know, the economic situation is as is. And I know that you're going to come back at me and say, you know, the government hasn't made it any better. But that was the reason why the government came together in the way that it did. And, you know, that is what they're supposed to be focusing on. So the idea that the government was going to dissolve itself over reform of one of the chambers is just not realistic. And I could just...
You'll never make it the number one priority until you make it the number one priority.
I could just
imagine, take the pain.
I can just imagine how Labour would have reacted if that had have happened.
Yeah, we'd have killed you, but you would have said, I've changed the House of Lords reform, I can die happy, I have made a difference to the democracy of this country, and that for me, I'm a Liberal Democrat, it's the key part of my identity as politically, so it doesn't matter if I lose MPs, I've made a difference.
Well, I've said previously that if I was in like an MP or, you know, a minister, and I had to sacrifice my own career as a politician in order to get, say, drugs reform law through, I would. I would do it because for me, it's that important. It's more important than my own individual, you know, political career. I can't really imagine how a situation like that would arise, but I would. But I think, again, you're being unrealistic because I think what would have happened is the government would have dissolved. There'd have been an election. Labour might win. The Tories might win. Maybe there'd be another hung parliament. I don't know. But whatever, House of Lords reform still wouldn't happen.
I don't think the government
so they'd have killed themselves
in a terrible state. You didn't need to bend over and you did. Well, and that's been the story of this coalition. And it's not an attractive story for people who want to try and sell any system that's going to increase the likelihood of coalition government.
OK, well, I'll tell you how it goes on the doorsteps in a couple of years time. I think you're probably right to an extent in that it is a difficult sell. But the circumstances have been massively against the party. And I think that there will be a narrative that we can sell, that, you know, we have been able to achieve a reasonable amount given the circumstances we were in. And one of them is going to be the tax threshold, because it was in our manifesto and it wasn't in either of the other two parties' manifestos. And whether it's on one political axis or another, it is a big win and the Lib Dems are right to trumpet it. Anyway,
it's a big win. It doesn't change anything, any narrative. You've done nothing to make this a more... a country that has that broader perspective. And that's a real shame, I think. It's a real shame. We're still a two-party state. We just have one party that chooses sides every now and again.
Well, 3 years and a seventh of the MPs. You know, we can do what we can do. I feel like we're getting into a bit of a circular discussion now, and I suspect we'll probably come back to this in future podcasts as well. Just before we move on, we have moved on from IDS and pensioners, but I just wanted to briefly touch upon universal credit, because we talked about this on the podcast before, and just to recap for anyone who isn't aware, I think universal credit has the potential to be an absolute disaster, not because of the principle. I think the idea of rolling up these benefits and trying to make sure work always pays in principle is a good thing. But it relies on a massively complex computer system that in some of the trials has already been shown to have failure rates of up to 30%. So I think if they roll, well, when they roll this out, because it seems like they are doing it, in fact, it's starting tomorrow, that there is a potential for this to be this government's poll tax. I've used that phrase before. And I just spotted something today that makes the parallels with the poll tax even more stark, which is that apparently they're trialling this for the first year in six different places in the northwest of England. I think Ashton-under-Lyne, a few other places around there. And that is a very strong echo with the poll tax, which was first trialled in Scotland in 1989 before it was rolled out across the rest of the country in 1990. And the, you know, the Scots still haven't forgiven the Tories for that. That was certainly one of the big things that was used against them in subsequent election campaigns. I mean, there are other things that the Scots generally don't like the Tories for as well, but that was a big one. And I just wonder, you know, it's like almost a scorched earth thing for the Tories that, you know, they're happy to roll this stuff out in areas where they don't have that many MPs. Anyway, I just found that really striking that I'm drawing this parallel with poll tax and then they go and do that. And I suppose they've got to trial it somewhere, but why don't they trial it in their own heartlands? It's their policy.
Yeah, I mean, they'll probably tell you that they need places with a certain profile of benefits. But also, they're not even trialling proper universal credit. They're making it so that there are... I mean, I was reading that the scheme in Thameside will be limited to 300 people. They're keeping it to, you know, single people without children. So actually, this trial is nothing of the sort. So it won't actually discover the bugs that might be in the system, because they're keeping it to the most simple cases, which is not how you trial an incredibly complicated and difficult system.
No, you're supposed to have the hard cases, the edge cases, and you're also supposed to have a representative sample of people as well. I mean, yeah. I work in software. That's not how I'd test a system if I was rolling it out. But then I don't work in political system software, so maybe the rules are different. I don't know.
I mean, it's just crazy. It's just crazy. I mean, I think you're right that it is going to be an absolute disaster. I mean, I remember talking to a Labour minister about this, when it was first being trialled, and they said, well, look, we're not massively against the principle. And there are issues about including housing benefit into it because of the complexities and the differences of housing benefit. But not against the principle, we just have literally no idea how it's going to work. And I think the problem is neither does IDS or anyone at DWP.
Yeah. Right. Well, we'll maybe know fairly soon what the initial results of these trials are. But as you point out, it's not testing the cases that it needs to be testing anyway. So maybe we won't know for a lot longer than that.
And they'll probably go, oh, it's been a massive success on these 300 really simple cases. Therefore, we must roll it out. And then, you know, by the time it's actually rolled out fully, it will be the next government's problem. Yeah. And that's, you know,
well, that is right, because they've said it's a 4-year rollout program. So, yes, you're right. It is going to be pushed into the next parliament, at which point it could easily be someone else's problem. So that, again,
at which point they'll start attacking us for running it badly.
That's politics, baby. All right.
You lot will be just as bad.
Oh, yes. We're nothing if not hypocrites, Emma. You know that by
now. Don't worry, I know that.
Yeah. Just before we finish, we did want to just touch briefly on the local elections.
Yes.
When we did the podcast last week with Grace Fletcher Hackwood, we did talk about UKIP in the context of the local elections. We want to touch upon that again, but a slightly different aspect here, which is obviously they're running, I think it's 1,700 odd candidates across the country, which is far more than they've ever run in comparable elections before. And it seems to have led to some problems. There've been a few candidates in the last few days, and it's been interesting to see how the narrative has shifted. Actually, the media has done what the media always does, which is they've been bigging up UKIP for ages now, and they've been, you know, look at the phenomenon, and they've done really well in these by-elections, and isn't Farage brilliant on the media, da di da di da. And then suddenly it's the tall poppy syndrome. They're now trying to knock them down off the pedestal, and they're doing this, one of the ways they're doing it is by finding some of these candidates who have said rather unsavoury things in the past and have written unsavoury things. And some of them are apparently former BNP members, or at least BNP sympathisers.
You've got a former BNP member, a woman who thinks the Jews are responsible for the Holocaust and 9/11. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And I suspect this is what happens when a party develops too rapidly.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, is it that extraordinary? Where have these 1,700 people come from? I mean, I don't know how many members UKIP has got, but, you know, even big established parties sometimes find it difficult to get candidates in some areas. So, you know, the idea that an upstart party that really, it's not a grassroots party, it's, you know, it's a national party that is trying to get footholds in different places around the country. So, you know, it's not surprising to me that some of these candidates are going to have a less than savoury background. I mean, I got into a bit of a discussion on Twitter yesterday, because I was asking, because they were saying, no, these UKIP candidates should have been vetted. And I said, well, I've stood for council election for the Lib Dems a couple of times, and I don't think I've ever been vetted. And then I had a load of Lib Dems contact me, mostly publicly, a couple privately, saying, you should have been vetted. What are you talking about? That's Lib Dem, you know, it's in the constitution that's supposed to happen. And I think the problem is, what it boils down to is my understanding of what the word vetting means. Because what they were saying is, well, they should have interviewed you, and they should have asked you if there's anything in your past that would embarrass the party. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, actually, yes, they did do that. You know, when we were sitting around and, you know, I was being asked to stand, they did ask me those questions. And also, they know me pretty well anyway. And it was probably a bit less formal than perhaps the strictly formal process. But they did do it. But that's not really what I understand the word vetting to mean. I understand it to mean they've done a background check. They've done research. They've, you know, they've looked into you. And I certainly think that when you've got newspapers like The Sun saying these candidates should have been vetted, I think that's what they mean. I don't think they mean that you've taken them out for a drink and said, you're a good egg, aren't you? Yeah, great, right, off you go. I don't think they mean that at all. And actually, that starts to become very problematic, because are parties expected to research and vet, in my, you know, by my definition of what vetting means, all their candidates? It's not really realistic, is it?
It's not.
How does it work in a Labour Party?
In terms of resources, I don't think it would work. The problem you've got is when you can build up quite easily a narrative of who's attracted to a particular kind of party, and the EDL have said that they're going to support UKIP, and you know, you've got these ex-BNP, BNP are falling apart internally, so of course some of them are going to be attracted to another rightist party. So if you are the people in charge of making that party take the next leap, my strong feeling would have been to do that more incrementally and better, rather than try and run 70 and pretend that you're a national campaign that's going to challenge properly for the next general election. I think that they could be building a stronger and better machine if they did it smaller and focused on it better. But I suspect that they've just gone, hey, everyone wants to come and be a member of the UKIP. Let's go. You can do it. You can do it. You can do it. Oh, crap, we haven't got any policies. Let's buy some from a think tank. Let's go. Oh, stick Farage on the telly again. Now everything will be all right. And, you know, that's not actually... That's how you build a short-term momentum campaign. It's not how you build a long-term political party.
Well, it comes back to the thing I've said before, which is that the party doesn't have any proper grassroots. And you're right. I think it's not quite astroturfing, is it? Because I think, you know, if you ask these candidates...
No, they represent a very real group of people within
exactly.
the country.
Yeah. It's not a very coherent movement, though, is it?
I read two fascinating things recently about UKIP. One was that there was a survey done where they made up a piece of legislation. I think it was called something like the Public Administration Act of 1975.
Oh, we covered this on the podcast last week.
Oh, you've already covered it, Dan.
I talked to Grace about this. Yeah, and you're right. It was absolutely fascinating. Basically, the results of that were that, you know, UKIP are just against stuff. It doesn't even really matter what the stuff is. They just don't like it.
The other extraordinary thing, and I don't know if you covered this on the podcast too, was the fact that a UKIP supporter was asked, well, what is so great about Great Britain? And his response was, the past. And that is UKIP in a nutshell, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's the party of harking back to the stuff that John Major talked about, you know, cricket on the green and, you know,
warfare and cycling nurses,
exactly, all of that stuff. It's like the world view of the Daily Mail, isn't it? It's what the Daily Mail want Britain, or probably more accurately England, to be. I think it will be interesting to see what happens with this, because this whole tall poppy thing that the media are very good at, you know, now that they've started going for UKIP, I wonder if there's a bit of momentum behind that. And it might not just be the odd candidate that's, you know, got dodgy views and, you know, had a dodgy past or whatever. But there'll be other things that they might start to attack now. And maybe they won't give Farage such an easy ride as he's been getting. You know, it's a standard thing, isn't it, that once parties start to become successful, the media do want to knock them down a bit. So I think
they'll leave it until after the Europeans. I think they'll want to see them do well in the Europeans.
Mm.
I think that the right-wing press, the ones who are trying to convince the Tories to be more like UKIP, or do a deal with UKIP, even some of them, are hoping to continue to use UKIP's continued success as a stick to beat David Cameron.
Mm. Possibly, yeah.
And it doesn't matter really what The Guardian think about UKIP. People who read The Guardian don't tend to vote UKIP.
No, I think you're right there, actually. Okay, well, we should probably wrap it up there. So we'll be back next week, and that will obviously be after the local elections, which are happening this Thursday. I have got my dates right here, haven't I? It is in...
You have, yes.
Isn't it? Yeah, so we can have a good chat about...
I'm in London. We haven't got elections, thank God.
Actually, I don't think we've got elections around here either.
My dad, on the other hand, has been wearing out his shoe leather in Hertfordshire.
Right, okay. But it's still a significant set of elections. Although, as usual, I think people should be voting on local issues, but they'll do... Whatever happens, they'll be interpreted through a national filter anyway. And it's like, you know,
If you're voting on local issues, how does the income tax work for that?
Yeah, good point. Exactly. I don't think we should be campaigning on national issues at local. There was an internal debate going on about this, and a number of people agreed with me about that. But anyway. OK, so just remains for me to thank Emma for being with me tonight.
Thank you, Mark.
Missed
nice
you the last
couple
of weeks. So, yeah, good to have you back. And I've just dropped my pen, so it's going to come out nicely on the podcast. And I'd also like to thank Audio Boo, who very kindly hosts the podcast. And I'd also like to thank Kevin McLeod of Incomputech.com for the theme music. And we'll be back next week.